Hello, and welcome to our conversation about behavioral and mental health. My name is Jen Toman, and I work for Catholic Charities of Baltimore. I'm here today with Dr. Enrique Oviedo. He is the medical director at Villa Maria Community Resources Behavior Health Clinic. Dr. Oviedo, would you mind sharing a brief background on yourself?
Sure. So I went to medical school at the University of Buffalo, where I was born and raised, and I moved down to Maryland in 2007 and attended the University of Maryland for my adult psychiatry residency. I then went on to do a 2-year fellowship in child psychiatry, also at Maryland. And then I started working for Catholic Charities in 2012. And within a year of being at Catholic Charities, I was seeing so many addiction issues at the clinics I was working at, and it was really frustrating not being able to treat these people, not being able to help them, and I just heard over and over that they were having difficulty accessing care, or they felt they weren't being respected the way they were at Catholic Charities when they would go to other clinics. Or just that it was simply too hard to coordinate medical appointments, psychiatric appointments, substance use disorder appointments, and it was just a lot for a lot of people. And I was asked the question over and over, you know, why can't you treat my opioid use disorder? Why can't you help me with my alcohol problem? And I was in that. I was met with that scenario often enough that I said something has to give. I don't know how I'm going to be a psychiatrist for the next 30 years and not be able to help these people. So with the support of Catholic Charities, I went back to do a second fellowship in addiction psychiatry in 2014, completed it in 2015, and came right back to Catholic Charities. Where I've been, so now it's been a total of 8 years, and I was about 2 years ago promoted to medical director for substance use disorder treatment for Catholic Charities.
You've probably heard of things like methadone or naloxone, medicines that are used as sort of a trade or rescue from opiates to help users stop using. But while those medications are more common than they used to be, there's actually a lot of controversy about MAT, or medication-assisted treatment of substance use disorders. If they're going to help, why is there controversy? That's what we're talking about today. As a full disclosure, several Catholic Charities Villa Maria Community Resources Behavioral Health Clinics do use MAT for individuals with opioid or alcohol use disorders. Let's start off with a clear understanding. What myths should we dispel first about MAT?
Sure. So maybe the most important myth to dispel is that MAT with Suboxone or methadone, it is not substitution treatment as it used to be called. We are not replacing one addiction with another. So when somebody is in the grips of addiction, they're not functioning properly. Their life is consumed by obtaining and using a drug such as heroin because their brain demands that steady supply of that particular substance. MAT is treatment and it helps people regain their functioning. So unlike heroin, methadone and Suboxone are opiates that are long-acting medicines which do not produce the euphoria or the overwhelming pleasurable experience, feelings that heroin does. So because heroin is so potent and it starts acting so quickly, that's what leads people to uncontrollable drug-seeking behavior. Conversely, Suboxone and methadone last in the body for over 24 hours and can be dosed in a therapeutic way that curbs the brain's cravings for opiates. And when dosed correctly and used correctly, people don't get high off of methadone and Suboxone. And that's an important distinction. You know, when people are using heroin, they are stuck in a cycle of finding drugs, using drugs, being intoxicated, and then being in withdrawal, and then the cycle repeats. When people are receiving MAT, they are free from that cycle. They're free from the debilitating physical effects of opiate withdrawal. They are free from that cycle so that it allows them the opportunity to work on recovery, to get physically healthy, to get psychologically healthy, and it helps prevent and avoid that relapse cycle that affects so many people while they're struggling with addiction. As a closing thought there, you know, in my mind, you know, recovery is defined by the ability to perform basic functions and fulfill responsibilities without drug or alcohol use. And that is absolutely achievable with medication-assisted treatment.
So why is medication-assisted treatment controversial to everyone?
So I'm glad you asked me that question. A lot of the negative stigma surrounding MAT comes from the different ways of understanding addiction. So some people view addiction as a moral problem, a spiritual failing, a lack of willpower, and not recognizing addiction as a medical illness. So if you take one of those former points of view, you know, the use of MAT like Suboxone or methadone, it may seem like those things are a crutch or a weak moral choice. You know, however, the science of addiction medicine has progressed so much, and we now recognize addiction as a disease process just like any other medical disease, just like diabetes or hypertension or high cholesterol. We have a much deeper understanding of the genetics associated with addiction, and about 60% of addictions manifest because of the genetic predisposition to it. We have a much better idea now of the physiologic effects on the brain's opioid receptors when they become addicted to opiates, and the changes in the neural pathways that occur. You know, especially in the last 10 years, MAT for addiction treatment, over time it's becoming less and less controversial, given the preponderance of studies that show people receiving treatment with MAT, they're less likely to engage in criminal behavior, they're less likely to acquire or transmit HIV or hepatitis C because it eliminates needle sharing. We see a reduction in mortality. The statistics show that currently in the U.S. there are 2.1 million people with an opioid use disorder. And that's out of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA. And only 17% of people are receiving any kind of treatment. The economic burden of opioid use disorder is $78.5 billion a year. That's billion with a B. And these are costs associated with healthcare costs, emergency room visits, paramedic, EMT, utilization, lost productivity, criminal justice involvement. So the cost of treatment, you know, I was recently looking at the statistics, you know, to be treated with methadone or Suboxone, you know, 1 week of treatment is about, you know, $100 or less per person, including the medication itself, the doctor's visit. And so just from a dollars and cents standpoint, it is so incredibly cost effective to provide treatment, including MAT, than to let that other 83% go without treatment. We have about 50,000 people die of fatal opioid overdoses a year. And here in Maryland, in 2018, there were 2,087 opioid-related deaths. We don't have the 2019 numbers yet. I know it's apples and oranges, but I sometimes think about the opioid epidemic, and I kind of compare it to what we're experiencing with the coronavirus pandemic, and at last check, we'd had a roughly about 3,300 people die in Maryland of coronavirus so far. And to just think of the resources that we're mobilizing and everything we're doing to stem the spread of coronavirus and to reduce morbidity and mortality. And as an addiction medicine provider, I can't help but compare those two numbers and the number of opioid deaths we experienced last year. You know, it's not that much less than the number of people who have died from, you know, coronavirus. Think of coronavirus hit and think of how all of our lives have been changed and what we're all trying to do as individuals to help people to come together and deal with this crisis. I like the same mobilization of resources and the same access to care and that coronavirus is getting. I guess just to put things in perspective, that you know, this is how devastating opioid use disorder has been in Maryland and in the United States. You know, the past few years, we've been seeing right around 2,000 deaths a year. It's just staggering. It's hard to wrap my mind around how many people are dying each year.
We know that people in communities are often hesitant to support what are known as, quote, meth clinics or other types of places where individuals may get prescribed help for their addictions. What should we understand that we might not?
So as it relates to methadone clinics, you know, here in Baltimore, you know, in the city, I'm aware of, I think there's about 20 methadone clinics. And, you know, just like in any industry, I think there are a few bad apples. There are a few methadone clinics that are poorly managed, but I don't think those few are representative of the many well-managed methadone clinics. So people's concerns about methadone clinics, the loitering, the noise, the littering, the worry about, you know, crime. You know, when a methadone clinic is well-managed, you don't have any of that. And I've worked at several methadone clinics that were well managed, and those, when well managed, that those things simply don't happen. You know, the addiction community is well aware that is a concern. You know, we're trying to increase access to care to people in all areas, and that includes opening new substance use disorder facilities. And you know, people in the community, especially if they know that a methadone clinic or another SUD clinic is being proposed in their area. You know, I hear a lot of times, that sounds great just as long as it's not in my backyard. The way I like to think about it is I don't worry so much about people who are in treatment getting methadone or Suboxone. I worry about people who aren't receiving treatment for the addiction. You know, because unfortunately, those are people who are more likely to engage in criminal behavior. You know, if there's an area that has a high rate of addiction, high rate of opioid use disorders, a methadone clinic or another type of SUD facility is going to be the best thing for that area to drive down, you know, crime in that area. There are OTP clinics which prescribe methadone, and then there are OBOT clinics that primarily prescribe Suboxone. And you know, with the OBOTs, they're essentially function just like any regular medical office. It's very similar to when you or I go to our primary care doctor's appointments, and you know, there's no waiting in line to be daily dosed, and OBOTs don't have the same issues that methadone clinics do. And many people are unaware that there are OBOTs close by, and because when they're well run, there are none of these, you know, loitering, noise, littering issues. It functions just like any other business. And the most similar thing I can compare it to is just a regular primary care doctor office where people go, when people are sick, they go in for treatment. To tie that into what we're doing at Catholic Charities in our outpatient clinics, we're essentially functioning like an OBOT where, you know, I maybe see one patient for ADHD and then the next patient I see for an opioid use disorder. And there was a lot of anxiety and apprehension about the SUD population being mixed in with our usual clientele. But since we started this, 2-3 years ago, we have not had a single incident of a patient being belligerent or making a scene or someone feeling unsafe. Or, you know, these are people who are coming to us voluntarily wanting help. They want to be there. They're people just like anyone else. And it's been, you know, really validating to see how seamlessly we can bring somebody in who's struggling with opiates or alcohol or cocaine, and nobody knows. No one else in the waiting room can tell. It's really been a seamless integration of people and services.
There are some MAT that are rescue-based, reversing an overdose. What's the difference between those and the MAT we're talking about today?
Sure. So the one rescue medicine for an opiate overdose is called Narcan, and the generic name for that is naloxone. And its only function is to be used if somebody is displaying signs of an opiate overdose. So if somebody is unconscious, is displaying shallow breathing, their skin color is turning, you know, purple, you know, bluish, what anyone should do in that case, if they happen to have a Narcan kit, and many people do, I carry one around wherever I go. And, you know, if EMT paramedics come on the scene and they see somebody like that, that the first thing you should do is administer that Narcan. And it's a nasal inhaler, and you give them one puff in each nostril, and it's essentially an opioid overdose antidote. If it turns out that it's not a true opiate overdose, it does nothing harmful to a person. There's no negative side effects to it. Its one and only function is to undo an opiate overdose. So that's Narcan. So we have one rescue medicine, which is Narcan, and we have three FDA-approved treatments for long-term use. Those are methadone, Suboxone, and Vivitrol.
So you were talking about Suboxone and methadone, and you kind of already did, but can you tell us the advantages and disadvantages of each of those?
Let's start with methadone. Methadone, you know, the studies have shown compared to Suboxone or Vivitrol, which is, you know, an injectable medicine for opioid use disorder, the studies have shown that people receiving methadone stay in treatment longer compared to the other two options. So people who have been struggling with opiates for longer periods of time, or have had multiple relapses, or have been unsuccessful on Suboxone, or who struggle with housing or severe mental illness, you know, that's a profile of somebody who perhaps is going to do better in a methadone clinic, where going each day to ensure they're getting their dose, to having that higher level of structure and the more support with case management. You know, for a lot of people, methadone is a good option. When comparing methadone directly to Suboxone, methadone does tend to have, you know, more side effects. It is a little bit more sedating. It tends to cause a little bit more constipation, a little bit more nausea. So moving on to Suboxone, also known as buprenorphine, the major advantage is that it can be prescribed out of any doctor's office. So methadone can only be prescribed from a methadone clinic for opioid use disorder. Suboxone can be prescribed by any type of physician, out of any kind of medical office, as long as you've received the required training. So it's easier to maintain confidentiality when treated with Suboxone as opposed to methadone, because when you go to a methadone clinic, there's only one reason you go to a methadone clinic. But when somebody comes to see me or their primary care doctor, I may be treating them for depression or bipolar disorder or opioid use disorder. But when that person walks in and out of my office, nobody knows what it is they're receiving treatment for. So patients' confidentiality is better maintained this way. I think receiving care out of a doctor's office and not a methadone clinic, I think it helps reduce the stigma that this is a medical condition just like any other, and you don't have to go to a special designated place to receive care. It's okay to receive care for this by a primary care doctor, by a psychiatrist. So confidentiality, access, you know, very few people prescribe methadone. It takes a little bit more training. Suboxone's a lot easier to prescribe. You can essentially train any doctor, any nurse practitioner to do it. And, you know, given that access to care, access to addiction care is still the number one barrier facing us, facing addiction in America, that's such an advantage of Suboxone that any psychiatrist, any nurse practitioner, any GP, you know, can do this. Suboxone's a little safer than methadone in that it's, you know, it's almost impossible to overdose on it. Even if patients take 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 times what they're supposed to take, it has a ceiling effect, which essentially drastically limits the risk of overdose on it. And on top of that, if somebody tries using heroin or prescription opiate on top of Suboxone, they don't feel it because the Suboxone blocks the opiate receptors and it blocks the effect from any other opiate that a patient is trying to use. The third medicine approved for opioid use disorder is called Vivitrol, and it's an injection that goes in the glute once a month. This is a good option for people who are perhaps early on in their opioid use disorder, patients who are young, who haven't had many relapses, who haven't yet been on methadone or Suboxone, or for patients or families who simply say, we want to try a non-opiate option for recovery. And that's what distinguishes Vivitrol from methadone or Suboxone, is that it's a non-opiate. And for a lot of people, that's how they want to proceed with their recovery. So that's its advantage. It's a non-opiate. It's when you're using it, you're no longer exposing the brain to an opiate. So the question is, why wouldn't everyone just go on Vivitrol? Why would you choose an opiate over a non-opiate as treatment? So the studies have shown, for the most part, most people don't stick in treatment very long on Vivitrol. They tend to drop out of treatment at much higher rates. And because it's a non-opiate, that person's tolerance for any opiate is much lower. And after using Vivitrol, once it's worn off, it only lasts in the body for about a month. Once it's worn off, if somebody goes on and resumes using heroin, heroin laced with fentanyl, their risk of overdose is very, very high. There's risk that you take with starting Vivitrol, and that if the Vivitrol is stopped, the patient is at higher risk for a fatal dose afterwards.
So you require that individuals receive MAT from you also receive therapy. Why is that?
So, you know, here at Catholic Charities, anyone who comes in who's on Suboxone, who's on Vivitrol, we require that they work with a therapist. So the medication is not a cure, and there are things that the medication can't do. People who are early on in recovery, you know, they need support. They need help developing coping skills. They need help setting goals. They need help organizing their life and picking up the pieces. And for those who've experienced trauma, and many of them have, you know, they benefit from trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and trauma-informed care. These people, they need help rebuilding their support system. They need help figuring out how to make new friends, how to reestablish their connections with their family. There's so many things they need help with. They often need financial assistance. They need help, you know, applying for job readiness programs or applying for a job and trying to get back into the workforce, there are several forms of therapy that are evidence-based that help people with substance use disorders, and those include motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy. And, you know, lastly, people in early recovery, it helps for them to crisis plan if they have a slip or a relapse, and they benefit from talking about, you know, changing the people, places, and things in their life, the things that may have contributed, led to the development of their addiction. You know, they also benefit from talking about how do they deal with their cravings, how do they deal with drug cues that in the past would lead them to go slip or relapse. There are so many things that lead to relapses, including one of the famous acronyms in the addiction world is HALT, being hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And I would even add boredom onto that. And the medication doesn't necessarily help people think about what am I going to do when I'm bored and angry and lonely. Working with a therapist and being involved in individual therapy, you know, really nicely complements nicely what the medication is doing to help change things in the brain.
If someone came to you and said, I need help, I need medicine, what is the process for evaluating their addiction and need?
So whether somebody's struggling with opiates, cocaine, alcohol, smoking, nicotine, the medical world, we're at a place, or at least I'd like to think we're in a place where, you know, anyone can approach their primary care doctor or go see any psychiatrist. And I'd like to think we're past that point where people don't have to feel ashamed about bringing this up. For a long time, there was a lot of shame in admitting it and talking about it. Stigma is down. And so if somebody's struggling with any substance, you know, I would encourage them to start with their primary care doctor or seek help from a mental health clinic and including going to see a psychiatrist. And, in 2020, it's okay to admit and to say, I want to stop smoking and I need help, or, you know, I can't stop drinking. My drinking is out of control. I need help. I got hooked on opiates and I need help. So I'd say accessing your primary care physician or pediatrician or seeking help from a psychiatrist are all places where you can access care and get help.
Have you seen that a lot of these opioid or any addictions, people tend to have another mental health issue along with it?
Yes. So people with any kind of mental health disorder, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, that puts them at risk for developing a substance use disorder at some point in the future. And it works the other way around. People who have substance use disorders are more likely to develop a primary mental health condition, major depression, panic disorder. There's so much trauma that occurs when people are struggling with substance use disorders. You know, particularly women are a vulnerable population. There are a lot of women who are, to put it quite frankly, end up becoming a commercial sex worker just to fund their use. And there's so many traumas that occur when somebody's not receiving treatment. And so a lot of people, as they achieve the recovery and get help, you know, it turns out they've developed a trauma, they have PTSD, they're experiencing, you know, trauma reactions, PTSD related symptoms. So yes, one puts you at risk for the other and the other way around.
Since the pandemic started, have you seen an increase or decrease in addiction patients?
So most providers of OUD treatment, right when the coronavirus hit, March, April, we all saw a decrease in people seeking treatment. And I think that was partly because people were anxious. People were anxious to go out in public. You know, people didn't want to acquire the coronavirus. So our intakes had been relatively steady for, you know, years, and then we saw this precipitous drop when coronavirus hit, and in June, July, we've now seen a kind of a resurgence in people seeking treatment. I think now that people are able to kind of wrap their heads around, you know, what's going on, and they know what reasonable precautions to take out in public, people are now back seeking treatment again. Some other trends that I've seen, I've seen smoking rates way up, both among teenagers and adults. And I see a lot of people self-medicating their anxiety with smoking. Alcohol usage is way up, both in, you know, a lot of the newspapers have published the alcohol sales, and alcohol sales shot up quite dramatically and have been up during the duration of this opioid epidemic. I have more people seeing me telling me they're drinking more frequently. More people who didn't previously used to be daily drinkers are now drinking every evening to deal with stress and anxiety. I have more people telling me for the first time they've lost control of their alcohol use, and for the first time feel like they need help with the alcohol use disorder that's developed. And marijuana cannabis use is also, I've seen it way up both among adults and teenagers. And again, it's, I hear it over and over, people feeling overwhelmed and stressed and anxious, and they're using all of those substances just for temporary relief and escape and numbing.
Do you have anything else to share with us today?
You know, I guess I would, the one thing I would add is I like to compare substance use disorders to other chronic medical conditions just so people can kind of draw parallels. So, you know, take diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol. Once those disorders, once those diseases start, you know, it is very rare that once somebody becomes diabetic that they're able to make the lifestyle changes, the diet and exercise changes to return to being non-diabetic. You know, in my experience, 99% of people who once they develop type 2 diabetes, they have it for the rest of their life, and they often require medication for the rest of their life. There are very few people who are able to make those substantial life changes, the exercise, the changes in choices of foods and portions to return to being, you know, not diabetic. We never think of insulin or oral diabetes medicines like metformin. No one really thinks of those as crutches or substitution treatment. And we don't shame people with diabetes. We don't shame people with hypertension. Kind of the way we talk and think about those people is, okay, it happened. It's water under the bridge. What can we do right now? What can we do to make you better? What can we do to reduce morbidity and mortality? What can we do to improve quality of life as best we can? And, you know, although we continue to encourage exercise, healthy lifestyle, being mindful of diet and portion control, people continue to take their cholesterol medicine and their diabetes medicine and their antihypertensives. And it's the exact same thing with the substance use disorder. Okay, it happened. And I want to emphasize, most of the time it's because of the underlying genetic predisposition. And a lot of the time, the person was predisposed because of having multiple adverse childhood experiences as a youth, or past traumas, or not having access to mental health care or good somatic care. You know, everyone has a story. And when you hear each person's individual story, the vast majority of the time at the end of the appointment, I'm left feeling like, gosh, this wasn't this person's fault. You know, something happened that put them at risk, something out of their control. It's been well documented in the 90s and the 2000s that medicine, we mismanaged pain and we overprescribed opiates. And there are many, many people out there struggling with heroin because their pain was mismanaged by by a doctor, and they were overprescribed opiates. They were given opiates for too long of a time, too potent. And I've heard so many cases where someone was either in pain management or receiving opiates, and the doctor quickly stopped the opiate. There was no tapering process. And through no fault of that person, they went into opiate withdrawal, which is an awful, horrible experience. And the majority of those people resorted to getting heroin off the street to treat their opiate withdrawal. So, you know, I hope one thing people take away is to, you know, people struggling with opiates and addiction, it's easy to marginalize this population. It's easy to write them off. But when you hear an individual story and you hear enough individual people's story, it becomes much easier to be sympathetic and empathetic. And when you really allow yourself to adopt the disease model of addiction, it then rehumanizes people.
Thank you to Dr. Enrique Oviedo, Medical Director at Villa Maria Community Resources Behavioral Health Clinic. That's all we have today for medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. If you think you have a mental or behavioral health challenge, or if you want to end an addiction, go to catholiccharities-md.org/behavioralhealth and click on the Behavioral Health Clinic link. We have more topics on behavioral and mental health this week. Be sure to check them out. Thanks for listening.